This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalbanks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Hello, my name's Luke Hart, and joining me today is Professor Michael Shara from the American Museum of Natural History. Thank you for being with us today, Michael.
Hello, pleasure to be here.
Okay, so I'd just like to take a quick second to ask you a few questions, and I wanted to know a lot about the American Museum of Natural History because it's awesome. I'd love to visit someday. Could you please just tell us a little bit about what goes on in the aspect of your job curating the museum? What does that involve day to day?
Sure. The title is Curator of Astrophysics. I'm one of three curators of astrophysics. We are the equivalent of university professors in that we are responsible for the care, the maintenance of the collections in the museum. The museum has 35 million specimens, from insects to a million fish, a million birds, a million bats, and so on, and hundreds of thousands of dinosaur bones. In the case of astrophysics, we don't have any stars or galaxies under glass jars, but we do have, of course, as many petabytes of data. So our collections are entirely digital and inside computers. The idea of the American Museum of Natural History is one, of course, of great collections of much of the world's natural history on display, but it's also a research institution. Of the 1,200 people at the American Museum of Natural History, 200 have PhDs or are studying for PhDs. We have a graduate school. So we are really both a university and a museum and a great, of course, teaching center.
Fantastic. So with all that, what is it about the museum itself and the job that you do that you really enjoy? What's the aspects that you enjoy?
Well, I would have to say all of it. The functional duties that I have, that is, if you will, the taxes, in a sense, that I pay. I'm not obligated to teach because we don't do graduate courses in astrophysics, though I do have graduate students from Columbia University who do come and are resident with us and, in fact, have done their PhDs with me and with the other curators. So we do mentor graduate students and oversee their PhD research. But the functional work that I do is actually designing either space shows for our planetarium, a large 3D immersive experience, or designing exhibitions, special exhibitions, that appear for perhaps 6 or 8 months at the museum and then travel to other venues. So in 2001 and 2, I was able to collect most of Einstein's papers, the original papers, and I've held his field equations in my gloved hands. And then in 2011, 2012, 2013, there was an exhibition called Beyond Planet Earth, which was envisioning where humans will go in the next 500 years, how we will expand off the Earth, terraform Mars, expand into the rest of the solar system, start conducting mining in the asteroid belt, and then begin the tentative steps outside the solar system. So it's really a combination of exhibitions, space shows, management of our very large data collections, and of course, a lot of engaging the public.
Wow. Could you possibly tell us about maybe one of the exhibitions that you've held recently? Like what sort of thing's been going on?
The exhibitions that we have vary. The special exhibitions vary. We happen to have one right now on mummies.
Wow.
There was a marvelous expedition called Race for the Pole, which was the attempts to get to the South Pole, Scott versus Amundsen. One of our curators did a marvelous job on that one. We've had multiple great dinosaur exhibitions. One of my favorites was also about 4 or 5 years ago called Fighting Dinosaurs. It's the only find that's ever been made of two dinosaurs. They've got death grips on each other. They're not very large dinosaurs, but you could see them in combat. And clearly they succeeded in killing each other during the combat and then were buried in ash or lava or whatever it was that buried them and preserved them for the many millions of years. But we have exhibitions that are entirely cultural. There was a beautiful exhibition on Cuba. The United States, of course, has been utterly disengaged and, in fact, had sanctions on Cuba for much of the last 40 years. So we were the first museum that was able to go there, engage with people in the street as well as in the government, but mostly in science, and we held large collecting expeditions there. So our expeditions really span all of biology, both invertebrate and vertebrate biology, as well as astrophysics, earth sciences, anthropology, really almost every area of human interest.
Fantastic. I love dinosaurs, but I feel like I owe it to the listeners to maybe get back onto topic of astrophysics, as it were.
Sure.
So we're very privileged today to have you talking at the JBCA colloquium about nova and supernovae. Could you possibly, for our listeners, give a bite size into novae and supernovae and sort of the differences and the features that they exhibit?
Sure. Novae are all recurrent phenomena. Every classical nova, or now called classical nova, that we see going off in the sky will erupt many tens of thousands of times over the course of its history as a nova, and that may be a billion years in length. So we expect that most novae will erupt every 10,000 or 100,000 years. What is a nova? Well, in every case, it's a binary star.
Okay.
It's a star like our own sun, a hydrogen-fusing star, which is locked in a very tight embrace with a much smaller star called a white dwarf, a stellar corpse. This is an object about the mass of the sun, but about the size of the Earth, so it's perhaps 500,000 grams per cubic centimeter. And the white dwarf can be thought of as a kind of cannibal or a kind of vampire sucking hydrogen off of its hydrogen-rich companion onto its surface. When that Earth-size object, that Earth-size white dwarf, accumulates about a 100,000th or a 10,000th of its own mass, roughly an Earth mass of hydrogen on its surface, which is only about 1 kilometer thick, that hydrogen is going to combust, not in the chemical sense, but in the nuclear sense. So the hydrogen will start reacting in nuclear reactions with itself, generate a thermonuclear runaway, be blown off the surface, and brighten a millionfold. That's what we call a classical nova.
Wow.
The question has been for some time now, where do a very special kind of supernovas called type 1a supernovas come from? And for a while it was thought that they might be the origin, or the progenitors might be classical novae. That is, if you were able to assemble material quickly enough on the surface of the white dwarf, you could crush it under that the weight of the newly accreted mass and perhaps get the white dwarf beyond a certain almost magical mass called the Chandrasekhar mass, 1.4 times the mass of the sun, wherein the internal pressure of the white dwarf is not sufficient to prevent it from collapsing all the way down to perhaps a neutron star and making this special kind of supernova, which has been used as a standard or standardizable candle in astrophysics, and in fact led to the discovery of the dark energy a few years ago, or perhaps 15 years ago now. The idea that classical novae give rise to type 1a supernovas has largely been shown to be incorrect, say the last 10 or 15 years, except for one special case of nova, where if instead of an ordinary hydrogen-burning star like the sun, if you replace that with a red giant star, which is able to transfer matter much faster onto the white dwarf, then the hydrogen can burn very, very quickly and non-explosively and can, in fact, grow the mass of the white dwarf towards that 1.4 solar mass limit. This is a special case. We're still not certain if this can be a significant fraction of all type 1a supernovae, but there's at least one and now probably two good cases of observations of distant type 1a supernovae, where we do see a lot of hydrogen present, which indicates the presence of probably a red giant star. But this is still a distinct minority of all such cases.
How often do you see events such as the type 1a supernovae? So how rare are they?
Type 1a supernovae are about a quarter of all supernovae in the universe. You do see them both in spiral galaxies and in elliptical galaxies. That is, in relatively young kinds of stellar populations, stars that were only born a few tens or hundreds of millions of years ago. But you also see them in elliptical galaxies where there are no stars born more recently than, say, 8 or 10 billion years ago. And so it's clear that these are star systems that can emerge very quickly, or that can also take many billions of years to form, or can hang on there as something else before they do manage to undergo this kind of collapse. The second kind of model that has been very popular and makes a lot of sense is merging white dwarf stars. If you have a pair of white dwarf stars that orbit each other, they will very gradually lose energy and angular momentum through the emission of gravitational waves, gravitational radiation. We have just observed and just seen the announcement of merging neutron stars, and merging white dwarfs must be at least 1,000 times more common. There must be many, many, many more white dwarfs than there are neutron stars. And the formation of white dwarfs is also much less violent than the formation of neutron stars. So more of them will hold together. And so we think that these kinds of systems probably make the majority, if not the vast majority, of Type 1a supernovae. There's one escape hatch for that statement. It might be incorrect in certain special stellar populations. In spiral galaxies, we still don't really know. In elliptical galaxies, because of this preponderance of evidence that's been accumulating, including some of the things I'll talk about today in my own colloquium, we're pretty sure that the vast majority of such systems must be very old populations, which are almost certainly only these, or the vast majority, are these merging white dwarfs.
Wow, okay.
While we're talking about novae and supernovae, I did some reading, and I found quite recently, actually, in August, I believe that you led a study that found a nova that was predicted by, was it Koreans 600 years ago? Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, in 1437, and to be more exact, on the 11th of March in 1437, Korean imperial, I'm going to say astrologers, they weren't really astronomers, though they did observe the sky every night, so in some sense they were observational astronomers, did note the appearance of a new star or a guest star in their asterism, an asterism they called Wei, which we refer to today as the tail of Scorpius. And it's important to note that they did these observations from very close to what is today the large city of Seoul in South Korea. Seoul is at around 40-something degrees north latitude, whereas the tail of Wei, the Scorpius, is at minus 40 degrees declination. So this object was only a few degrees above the horizon. It would have been seen in March. The object could really not have been seen until almost twilight, only the last hour of the night. And in March, in Seoul, it's pretty darn cold. So these half-frozen astronomers noted the rising of a new star, something they had never seen before. It must have been pretty bright to catch their attention. They noted also that this star was seen for 14 days and then vanished and was never seen again. And that's too quick for a supernova. So the only thing it could have been, really, is a classical nova erupting. This was pointed out by Richard Stephenson at Durham many years ago, as well as other great historians of astronomy. And both I and Mike Bode, a colleague here in the UK, have been hunting for the remnants of this nova for much of the last 20 years. On and off, we haven't devoted our entire careers to it, but it's been one of those things that's been a thorn in our side, in our sides, because we have made predictions about what old novae should look like. If we clearly think that we understand what novae are like, then we should be able to say what this 580-year-old object should look like. And I, with some other colleagues, predicted way back in 1986 that an old nova, which for the first 10 or 20 or 30 or even 50 years after its eruption, looks like a very high mass transferring, very bright system, which is quite stable in its brightness, should, after a few hundred years, transition and become a much fainter object, which we call a dwarf nova, something which has hiccups in its brightness, which can brighten 10 or even 100-fold for a few days, as the accreting disk of matter around the white dwarf star collapses periodically onto the white dwarf. Hunting for it on and off, on and off, on and off, turned up nothing, because it turns out we were looking between the wrong two stars in the tail of Scorpius. The Korean record said that the new star was between the second and third star, and we searched assiduously, long and hard, found nothing there. about 18 months ago, I decided, well, there's so many new catalogs in astronomy, so much online data. Why don't I just expand the search twofold? As soon as I did, literally within 30 minutes, I found the nova. And the way I found it was by realizing that within these catalogs, there was both a newly found cataclysmic variable star, and there was an old planetary nebula, or believed to be planetary nebula, between the next two stars over, and there was a coincidence between them. Now, the people who'd found the cataclysmic variable had not realized it was sitting inside a planetary nebula. The people who'd found the planetary nebula had not found the cataclysmic variable. No one had put these two together. And when I went and looked at my own photographic plates from 30 years ago when I'd started the search, there was the planetary nebula, there was the cataclysmic variable. It was staring me right in the face, and I had seen it, and I had even noted it in my notes from 30 years ago, but ignored it because it was between the wrong two stars. It was in the wrong place, but it wasn't. Now, I was then able to go back and reconstruct why these two stars, the second and third star in Way, might not be the second and third star. They might only be the first and second. It depends on an interpretation of where the first star is. And the first star is defined by the easternmost star of the constellation. And that actually changed back, around 1000 AD because of the precession of the Earth. The Earth wobbles on a 24,000 year time scale. And that wobble changes the positions of stars very, very slightly. So if I use that interpretation, the location of the cataclysmic variable and the planetary nebula matched. How, though, could I prove that the two really were connected, and this really was connected to the nova 1437? That is where a bit of detective work and some luck came in. The cataclysmic variable that was known was off-center. It was not in the center of the planetary nebula. In fact, it was way off-center. And that made very little sense. Nova explosions should be, in some sense, relatively symmetric. They might be more elongated in one direction than the other. But the central star in all nova shells that we know of, up to about 100 years old, are pretty much at the center. This one, 600 years later, was really off-center, way off-center. And the answer I realized was that the nova, since it was so bright, had to be close. It had to be close, and if it was close, it could have a large proper motion, a large motion across the sky. That proper motion could then carry it away from where the explosion happened quite a bit in the course of 600 years. But the stuff blown off, the ejecta from the explosion, would in fact be slowed down very quickly by the interstellar medium, by the gas in the Milky Way. By analogy, imagine that you're zipping down the highway in your convertible and you have a bag full of confetti. You take some of the confetti and you throw it out of the car. Well, what will the confetti do? It will run into the surrounding air and it will rapidly stop and fall to the ground, whereas your convertible will keep zipping down the highway. If that was true, if the analogy is right, then the cataclysmic variable could well have moved away from the center. And the only way to check that is to look for instances or photographs of that cataclysmic variable as long ago in the past as possible to measure its motion across the sky. I was fortunate that there was a digitized photographic plate from 1923, which showed the same cataclysmic variable and some nearby reference stars, which happened to be much further away and hence not appearing to move. And when I lined up those two images and measured very precisely, actually, one of my colleagues did this very, very exacting work. Two of them did it independently of each other and came up with the same answer. We found that indeed the cataclysmic variable star was moving. More important, it was moving, let's say, straight downwards, but the center of the shell was straight upwards. So we could extrapolate backwards in time, back to 1437. And when we did so, we found that the cataclysmic variable was precisely at the center of the shell, allowing for the tiny bit of motion of the shell in that time. And that matching up is a kind of clock. It's actually a proper motion clock. Of course, we can't do carbon 14 dating on this. We don't see an arrow leading from the star back to where it came from. But in fact, we do, we do see a kind of arrow, which is the star's motion. And it's that proper motion clock that allowed us to really nail where the star was. And the lovely thing about it is that the star is now a dwarf nova. It has become much fainter. Its mass transfer rate has decreased enough to allow dwarf nova instabilities to occur in the disk of matter accreting around the white dwarf. And this is something that is supportive of the idea that old novae do not stay bright old novae forever, but their mass transfer rate decreases on a few centuries time scale. And in fact, they become dwarf novae for most of the time between nova eruptions. So they're rather like butterflies and caterpillars. They're the same objects, but they are in different states of development.
Mm. Fantastic. And that sounds like a years of work finally coming almost to fruition.
In many ways, it's more than two decades of wondering. You know, we didn't work on this without cease. In fact, we would try for a few weeks or months. Both of us would plow away at it, and we'd go to the telescope and look at various candidates and go home and, didn't work this time, but maybe we'll be smarter next time. And we would try and we would try. I guess about 8 or 9 years ago, both of us shelved the project and said, that's it. It's over. We've wasted enough of our careers on this miserable thing. It's a blind alley. We will not bark up this tree anymore. And we went on to do many other things, really until about 18 months ago when I had this sudden moment of thinking, well, I really should try one more time because there are these powerful tools and I'm only going to do it once for one day. If I can't find it in a day, I'm just going to take the whole file and chuck it in the garbage and never look at it again.
It was that one day.
That's when I found it, right.
Wow, amazing. That's brilliant. Another one of your sort of research areas, which I've read about, is that you're quite interested by low luminosity, what we would call faint stars. Mm-hmm. Okay. Very, very briefly, could you explain to the listeners sort of what those faint stars are and why we should be so interested in them?
Well, the idea enshrined in that, or at the center of that, is that not only do these objects become dwarf novae at some point, but they might go into an even deeper state, not of what we initially called hibernation, but of kind of suspended animation, wherein the mass transfer from the hydrogen-rich star to the white dwarf star actually stops or becomes so very low that it's undetectable. This remains, I think, the holy grail for us if we are ever to completely understand the very long-term evolution of the whole class of stars that we call cataclysmic variables. We don't yet have an ironclad case. And I would say that when the idea was first proposed that old novae, that nova become old novae, which become dwarf novae, was proposed, there was perhaps the kindest thing I can say is great skepticism. There were never catcalls at public meetings on the subject, but great skepticism. Today, I would say that that skepticism has largely gone away. The idea that there is a kind of cyclic behavior, that you go from high mass transfer to lower mass transfer states and back, is something that I would say much of the astronomical community accepts, though there are a few holdouts. Perhaps this NOVA 1437 paper has helped to push them in the right direction. But the idea that there are non-mass transferring systems remains highly controversial. I have a few candidates that I am looking at. Mm-hmm. I'd rather not tip my hand in public as to who they are, so I won't give you their coordinates, but I will continue to look at them with a few other colleagues. And I would hope that over the next 5 or 10 or 15 years, we can unearth at least one or two good ones also, and demonstrate that, yes, there is now no mass transfer between the white and red dwarfs, but there is an old nova shell, and perhaps via proper motions we can use that information or some other tricks we have up our sleeves to age date them with near certainty. And that, I think, would really square the circle. That would be the final step in demonstrating that this idea of great mass transfer rate variations is correct. But even if not, even if it turns out that we don't locate any, even if the idea of suspended animation ultimately is incorrect, I would say it's given a lot of impetus both to theorists and observers to go hunt for these things. And at least we've made the case that there is a partial decrease or a significant decrease in mass transfer. And that helps us to understand the long-term evolution of these otherwise enigmatic binary stars.
Fantastic. I don't think I've heard very much about low-luminosity stars, so that was a very interesting summary of this very active research topic, as it were. Well, I think I've almost run out of questions. Mm-hmm. The one thing I'd like to ask you very briefly is, obviously, with all this work and attending to the American Museum of Natural History, I suspect that you are in desperate need of downtime at some point. And I read that at one point you very much enjoy scuba diving. So is it scuba diving off in the Pacific, right?
It is. I love sharks.
Yeah.
I think that they are magnificent creatures, extraordinarily dynamic and designed, or rather evolved, to be both excellent hunters, but of course scavengers too. Mm. They are critical of being at the top of the food chain for helping to keep the oceans clean. And I love to scuba dive with them. I've scuba dived with all species of sharks, including once great whites, but I'm happy to say inside a cage when that happened. But essentially with all other species. And the very best place to see lots and lots of sharks on every dive typically is the South Pacific. I'm also a warm water diver. I don't like dry suits. I don't like diving in frigid conditions. The two or three best places I've ever dived are Rangiroa and Fakarava, north and east of Tahiti. Magnificent passes where you dive from the open ocean and the currents sweep you through beautiful canyons into lagoons, and also the island nation of Palau, wow, which has a magnificent place called the Blue Corner. If there are any divers out there, they know as well as I do that that is one of the most glorious spots on Earth. You dive along the reef, and then you take a hook, a reef hook, latch yourself into the rocks at the bottom, and a 4, 5, or even 6-knot current can sweep by you. It feels like being in a hurricane, and you're held in place by the hook, and you just watch the sharks feeding in front of you. So yes, that's what I love to do more than anything else with my downtime.
It's amazing. And I guess if there are any divers out there who didn't know about that, they do now, so they can go and check that out.
I hardly recommend Rangiroa, Fakarava, Palau. Oh, yes, and the Cocos Islands.
Fantastic.
Utterly, utterly magnificent.
Brilliant. So one last word from you, please, Professor. Sharks or supernovae?
Both.
Brilliant. Okay. Thank you ever so much, Professor Michael. Yeah, thank you very much. Cheers.
My pleasure.